Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4.
Ulcers, to rule out other causes such as HSV or primary infection. Generally, I think this is a real reasonable study. I think it poses an important study question that could be answered with the design of this protocol. And I think, subject to the concerns that I've raised, that I think it's a viable study within the ACPG and appropriate for the ACPG study design. Comments, questions?
Yeah. How could you make this a placebo-controlled study if I thought every distinct side effect?
I think a placebo, I mean, ideally, I think a placebo is a good idea. However, I don't think you can afford a doctor with a placebo. Because the doctor's going to know if the patient has five issues. On the other hand, having a patient go through the insertion of a placebo and the washing off in the morning, a placebo, it's not a big deal, but it isn't a huge decision. But the more important consideration, I think, is that an experienced GYN who has treated patients will probably be able to tell, even if the patient has almost no morbidity, if the patient has gotten positive from the changes in the vaginal feeling. So if we believe that there can never really be a true placebo, then I would favor the leading. If we think that if we really could be true placebo, we can consider. So I have my doubts.
Okay.
Can you take it?
That the analogy might be AZT and Dapsin in those studies with placebo control, where there are other parameters of laboratory that do make it clear, and yet it is relatively blind. If it does, it does make a similar experience. I think that there's some merit considering that. So, I don't know.
Yeah, no,
can I ask a question?
Okay.
Excuse me. Can I?
Okay.
I was going to say, isn't it possible to do two kinds of treatment? I mean, it seems highly unethical to do placebo if you actually think it's going to work, and if you know that there's going to be recurring.
Well, I think the issue is at this point.
Why wouldn't you use alpha interferon in this trial as a comparison?
Actually, well, we're going to get to that in a little bit.
Yeah.
I think the issue here is that basically what we have at this point is relatively limited data. For a lot of reasons, but relatively limited data on what the recurrence rate is among women who are HIV seropositive. Basically, one study that I've seen published. Now,
there's no published data that is taking care of HIV positive patients and show the difference in recurrence. You have to stand with that one. The literature has statistically been studying it for a while. That will soon be published in a small number of patients. HIV positives who recurred, the recurrence rate may be about 40% in the active group versus your standard 10% in HIV negative group. They're very small.
So without the 5-FU.
Just
right.
The standard therapy.
And the
so I think that, to say, well, if we know this, and how can we withhold therapy, I don't think that's appropriate at this time. I don't think we know much at all. And you're certainly not going to base a treatment on all the women in the country on a small pilot study from one place. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that even if there is a difference in recurrence, it doesn't mean that the therapy will address decreasing that incidence. It may be that the 5-FU cream gives you side effects and no difference in recurrence. And that's why we're doing the study. There is phase 1 and phase 2 data on the use of this medication to lower general tract neoplasia in HIV negative and immuno-incompetent patients without transplant.
And
so I think you have the background to bring 5-FU into the picture at this point, but instead of been demonstrated to achieve the goal that we hopefully will show.
Plus, in the context of doing the study, the patients that aren't receiving any therapy will be followed closely, and one would think then that you would be detecting changes earlier, and the data would be would go to some interim analysis that if there was any trend that was really showing a difference, the study could be stopped early and information be generated. And this is not unlike what happens with AZT, et cetera. So that doing this clinical trial in the context of not really knowing the women will be studied very carefully and watched very closely.
I think there's
the colposcopic exam is called for every 4 months in these patients. Even in recovery, we're talking about pre-invasive disease here. We're not talking about a life-threatening problem. It doesn't progress.
Can I say one thing? If we're going to talk about HPV, which is a real can of worms, rather than have a placebo arm, which I think is ridiculous, we have objective endpoints we can follow, and the thing we should be discussing is a reference laboratory, because you line up 5 different cytologists, pathologists, you get different readings, and that's our one objective endpoint, and we should focus in on that, not
we're working
confusing
on
ourselves with a placebo study. Anybody that's treated patients with 5-FU, those patients know. Mm-hmm. They know. You can't do a true placebo. You have to know if it's an acid or if vagina's going to burn, which I'm against, too. So, that's all I got.
We are working on a central thing for the biopsies, and everything is going to have to be confirmed by biopsy, not just assay pathology, both enrollment and endpoint. So I think that's a reasonable...
that's an objective endpoint. Not a gynecologist and psychologist argue amongst themselves. You can get 10 different pathologists and only get 10 different readings. So I think we really have to focus in on that. And the placebo arm doesn't move.
Any other comments?
I would just like to make one comment about the endpoints, that we do need gender-specific endpoints. As a whole, in all of the studies, just as a general comment.
We can't hear you down here.
The question is whether women could be on AZT on this trial.
The concern is that the careful stratification, one of the points about having a pelvic examination of women for antivirals is whether there's an antiviral effect either. We have to look at those for antivirals. So it might not.
A little bit of data on that. We looked at AZT use and didn't see an effect of AZT on the development of cervical neoplasia. There's been a study in anal dysplasia in men who also did not see an effect on the AZT on the development of dysplasia. And I think that to exclude women on AZT would basically be excluding the protocol. So I think that we can look at it retrospectively and see if they did have an effect, but I think from what we know now, the development of dysplasia has to do with the T4 count much more than if the patient is on AZT. And as you know, the AZT doesn't make a big impact on the T4 count for a very long time. It makes a small impact usually for a very short time. So that it may have an effect on the T4 count, but independent of that, I don't think there's enough data to suggest that it has a big enough impact for this patient.
Right, there's a confounding variable, I think, that it needs to be taken into consideration.
It has a bit already, because we're separating by 3 tiers, T counts over 500, 2 to 500, and under 200, and you would expect the second 2 categories would be on ACT in general, although not always. Let me answer some of Heather's points. We'll bring them up about the placebo. If a patient had active vulvovaginal neoplasia, that would have to be successfully treated and proven successful treatment for the patient to be in.
But you would take, for instance, someone who had a hysterectomy, but maybe had either vaginal dysplasia.
A patient who had a hysterectomy and had no cervix would not be helpful. But then it's a different disease. Now you're talking about, VAIN vein alone, without a cervix.
Okay,
and
so
that, although, 5-FU would probably be a treatment of choice, I don't think you can compare it to patients without a cervix. So I would think that patients who had a hysterectomy should not be helpful.
So in other words, you would not exclude people with vulvar or vaginal dysplasia that was treated, but they would have to have cervical dysplasia as well that was treated to be eligible for the study.
And the next point you put up was the difference between the reduction. The reduction would be, I actually said, 50%.
Okay.
A reduction from 4, we would help expect a reduction from 40% to 20% recurrence. So this is the low-dose steroids, there's really no answer to what dose is low dose and what is high dose. From my interpretation of data on lupus patients, that I would say anything that's 5 milligrams or less, the patient would be eligible. Anything more than 5 milligrams a day, the patient should not be eligible. But again, we yield to experts in rheumatology, you know, for their decision on that. If patients had vaginal ulcerations from ulcerative disease like syphilis or chancroid, they would not be eligible until that disease would be correctly diagnosed and treated and the ulcer would have gone away. If the patient had no ulcerative disease and she was successfully treated, she could then be entered on protocol. But even though the toxicity from clavicula is low, the main toxicity is the development of vaginal ulcers. And the dosages in this protocol probably less than 5% of patients. So if we can extrapolate from Krebs's data, when you use it every week, the incidence is 8% or 10%. But certainly you want to give it to a patient who already had an active ulcer. But certainly, if the patients were treated successfully, then they could be put on. And the usual gynecological criteria to diagnose an ulcer, diseases, herpes, or something like that, this should be applied, but we want to incorporate that as mandatory up front, like a herpes culture. I think it's a different step to the next level. So I think adequate treatment would probably imply that they would put it that way.
I guess some of this would be addressed in the protocol development stage.
Right, some of these are specific. I think we would all agree that because it's a side effect of the drug, you may need to treat some underlying diseases if they exist so that could be, because that's going to be part of your dose management. They develop an ulcer, they should probably stop or come off their spine. So that was part of the protocol.
I think you need to distinguish between the new ulcer or whether it's a reinfection again of the, like the herpes ulcer coming out of remission, or whether it's actually going to be the side effect of the drug.
Well, if it was a herpes ulcer and there was an ulcer, then it should certainly come out culture positive if it's an active ulcer. So I think
that's the issue, and it has to be incorporated into the protocol development, is what is the battery of tests that would be done?
The point is a good one. Any ulcer is... Our experience is that patients on 5-FU develop ulcers, you know, by far the most likely reason is that it's from the 5-FU. However, other reasons why patients develop ulcers should be ruled out, and of course the patient has history of herpes, you know, be cultured. But again, if, you know, we're expecting a fairly high level of gynecological care here. We're expecting that in the ACPG, certain people who are specializing in OBGYN, and in this particular will be recruited to take care of these patients and participate. And if that is the case, then I think anyone competent in the field should know how to deal with an ulcer and the differential diagnosis.
And you, part of your GYN is on site, not by referral then, to bring the gynecologist that you were just talking about,
well,
who are highly trained to monitor these women. Those are going to be on site, not by referral.
I think some of those are overarching concerns that the core committee has agrees with you that this whole idea of having a sort of a one-stop shopping for women to have all of their care in one site is the ideal. I think that as re-competition becomes, you know, in March and so forth, these are logistical questions that will have to be addressed by each site that would participate in the study. And we hope to have it be convenient for the woman that's going to be participating.
Yeah, I understand that. I was just, you know, because Mitch was just bringing that up, and I was wondering what it was specifically for his study, since that's what he was talking about.
Right, and I think that, I would say operationally, that that's a program issue that we would strive to get to the idea, but I'm not sure that you could speak for
everyone. It's a program issue, and it's also a big question mark. We're talking about the integration of women and OBGYN care into ACPGs that have previously not had it. Exactly how to go about that is a big question.
So I think that now that we have proposals on the table, the groups that are involved are going to start developing plans to get to that goal, and that's, you know, part of the logistic that
I didn't mean to lose my point. Let me just kind of rephrase it then. In your study that you're doing now, Mitch, do you have a GYN on board?
At our institution?
Right. Who's taking care of for the results you just gave us, reducing from 40 to 20, you know, that's a 50%. Are those good, you know?
It would seem obvious, but I'm a GYN oncologist. I don't treat patients with pre-invasive diseases at all, because I do almost all radical. In our institution, we have a separate service just for pre-invasive disease. All the people doing that service is culpa, laser, treatment of dysplasia. Okay? That's a very specialized kind of setup, we would hope. And I believe that most major medical centers and OBGYN departments have that setup. in my experience from around the country, tells me they do. If you have a big department in an academic place, there's somebody specializing in invasive disease. And sometimes it's a junior oncologist or an afternoon visit, they're overwhelmed, then it's usually not them. That would certainly be the goal, and I look by the ACTG centers, most of them seem to be concentrated major from that major medical center.
The
point would be that once this became a reality, each center would have to submit their site implementation plan to specify who would be doing it and make sure that they have the expertise necessary before they were approved to be a site to be implemented.
Yeah, some sort of GYN assessment involved with that whole plan.
If this proposal passes, when do you have a start date in mind?
This year, this century.
This year. You mean 92?
I'm in 92 already.
The process at this point is that once we have this meeting today, we'll be reporting to the core committee. Once the core committee satisfies themselves that this is a reasonable thing to do and they're happy with the way it's written and all that, then it goes to the executive committee for review, which would probably occur in January. And then if they approve it, then it gets, you know, then the report forms get done, the protocol gets developed.
So we're looking at late 92. With due
unless
process.
Unless we're optimistic, with due process. March or April, but that's probably a little too optimistic.
I would like to be optimistic and say the first half of 92, but, you know, it really depends on how we, you know, what implementation plans we can develop. So I think there are two processes going on here. One is trying to develop the concept sheet that will be approved and blessed and sanctioned by the executive committee, but the people on the executive committee are also going to be asking about site implementation as well. I mean, they're not going to approve something that wouldn't be able to happen.
Really?
So hopefully we can bring both of those pieces of information to the executive committee in January. So that's what we're working on. Probably one of the reasons of having this meeting then is to discuss both of the concepts sheets to get consensus as where it's going, what pieces need to go into this to give the group guidance and the proposer guidance. Then this will be submitted for executive committee in January review.
What are you looking first for accruing into this trial? And secondly, are you going to be looking outside of the ACTU sites and into some of the more community-based sites? And if so, with the liaison, what are you going to do in that case for gynecological assessment?
A sample size is proposed to be 97 in each arm, and I think there's a lot of interest on everyone's part to potentially include NICHD-funded sites and CPCRA-funded sites, as well as ACTG-funded sites. But I think at this point, our point is to review the proposal and the scientific merits and the pros and cons and the problems with it, and once we can get it to the point to get it to the executive committee, then deal with more of the operational issues of how can we get this available to as many women across the country as possible. And this afternoon what we need to do is review the scientific issues and clinical issues so that we can get it moving and get it to that point. So there are plans to try to expand the number of sites where this will be available, and the same caveats of site implementation plans and adequate gynecologic expertise before this drug is released.
Is there a stratification for primary dysplasia?
No. So we recognize two things. First of all, the different methods of ablation at different centers will vary. A lot of it's finances. Some places will just have cryo, they don't have the expertise or the money for laser. A lot of places are going to loop now. And then as you see in the protocol, cone biopsy, if the negative margins are adequate. What the literature does say is that all these therapies are basically equivalent. Maybe one study out of 10 or 12 that will show maybe for one selective indication laser might be better than cryo, which is very dubious. Basically, the laser, the cryo, the cone with negative margins, and the loop have equivalence, have success rates in the same neighborhood, CIN grade to CIN grade. So we're going to look at all of them as equivalent. Again, we could look at it retrospectively as a possible confounding variable. But again, implicit in this is that patients are going to be taken care of by competent people who know what they're doing, who, if treated correctly, the patient should be disease-free after treatment.
We can
ensure that to some degree by reviewing pathology, negative margins, insisting that diagnostic cones be done for positive ECCs and the usual indications, and that we can insist on. and get some conformity in that one.
There could be guidelines, you know, written into protocol.
And or even kind
of. Be necessary to look at material from the initial diagnosis to make sure the patients that we need to enroll really have pre-invasive disease, or are you just going to rely on the people taking care of them?
Well, it's an interesting question. Right now, the ACTG, there's no internal review for other malignancies like Hodgkin's lymphomas, non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, or pathologies. So right now, I'm told that the ACTG does not use central reading of pathology, which is a little bit different than I'm used to being an oncologist. Your central reading?
Yes.
Okay, I take that back. We do plan to do central reading. We're looking into that, both the cytology and histology, but I think more so for histology.
For histology,
which is by far the more important thing.
Would be the initial histology and the improvement.
And we have actually the people in mind, essentially, in this area, who would do that. And I apologize.
Could you just briefly tell us what the data are that suggest the use of prophylactic 5-FU as an application? You alluded to immunosuppressed non-HIV positive patients. Can you tell us briefly what that data is?
The data in immunosuppressed patients is almost all on renal transplant patients on immunosuppressive drugs and other immunosuppressed patients on usually high-dose steroids, like patients with sarcoid or lupus. Most of the data looks at patients who have failed standard therapy and then have been put on 5-FU regimens of varying degree. Prophylactic maintenance therapy have often just been a part of it. Sometimes it's 5-FU treatment of the vagina for, let's say, vaginal dysplasia followed by maintenance for the cervical disease standard therapy. Is there a study that looks exactly what we're looking at in other immunosuppressed patients? I don't think so. Exactly what we're looking at. We're looking at almost 2% of cervical prophylaxis against cervical dysplasia, but also recognize the multifocal nature of this problem, prophylaxis against vaginal dysplasia too, but not to treat vaginal dysplasia. If the patient presented us with vaginal dysplasia, we wouldn't treat it with maintenance prophylactic class, continuing by the requirement. So, in answer to one of the other comments, well, it's already proven to work, why are we even having to have a control on? You know, I would differ from that dramatically. And exactly for the use we're looking at, it hasn't exactly been studied in immunosuppression, but at least not a lot.
The other issue, I think, for the control arm at this point is the fact that the toxicity on anticipated toxicity is moving up.
And it might not work. I mean, the HIV-positive patients are similar. They're similar to renal transplant patients in some ways, but they're different in others. And your immunosuppression.
The point is that there are no data on prophylaxis for recurrent cervical dysplasia with 5-FU.
No control. Data and that data.
Are you including serotyping as far as information that you're gathering?
No, that's a whole other can of worms. We were not going to, and it can be included as an academic add-on. Okay? We're not use HPV data in any way, shape, or form for any treatment discussed. And the technology wasn't a burden to the ACGT or to the center. And we can pick a standard way to do a ViraPath or PCR on biopsies. It's doable, and it had a lot of academic information. And I think it would be desirable. Is it necessary for the care of these patients? It's not necessary. I think it would be advantageous, and almost would be a shame not to get all this good HPV data for these patients. But I wouldn't want it to be an obstacle if centers of ACG or finance to move forward.
I remember I suggest that we know if the agent's more likely to cause malignant disease more rapidly. We're thinking of those serotypes that are more likely to be a nuisance rather than a true neoplastic change or a change that will ultimately progress to neoplasia. But we're dealing with different issue when you're talking about someone who's in your compromise from HIV infection. And because if you treat it and you have pretty patients with 5-FU,
they'd be randomized to either interferon 3 million units per day administered subcutaneously or interferon same dose plus isotretinoin.
Yeah, I think we need to clarify this. It was somewhat confusing.
It's observation versus retinoic acid plus interferon.
So there are
two arms.
So there is a control arm.
Combo versus observation.
The cover sheet that came along with this was misleading in that regard. It was somewhat confusing.
Okay.
What it shows is two arms, one interferon and isotretinoin, and one interferon only, and doesn't mention the observation group. So two arms, one with observation and one with alpha interferon and isotretinoin, so we need to clarify
okay.
that.
Okay. So there's no interferon alone on
No.
Okay. They would be treated, and I couldn't tell from the concept sheet the duration of treatment. The follow-up would be for 1 year with evaluation every other month. The type of evaluation is not specified. But I assume it would include pap smear, colposcopy, biopsies if indicated, and also toxicity grading and some blood tests to look for hematologic and biochemical abnormalities. The endpoints would be recurrence of grade 2 or 3 intraepithelial neoplasia or development of invasive cancer. Or the development of unacceptable toxicity, grade 4 toxicity or grade 3 toxicity, which does not revert. And the plan would be to enroll 162 individuals in each arm. First of all, let me say that I think that the idea that this concept sheet proposes is a very interesting one, an important one to be looked at. I have some concerns, first of all, about the study design. One of my concerns is no longer a concern since there is a control arm, and I think that that's important in a study of this type for the reasons that have already been noted. My comments actually would apply equally well to the concept sheet just discussed. It's unclear what sort of local treatment is being utilized, and I understand Mitch's point that depending on where you are, certain types of treatment, such as laser, might not be available. I would still argue that it might be important to try to have some sort of stratification, perhaps as simply as whether you have an ablative therapy, such as cryotherapy or laser, versus loop or conization, where you actually remove tissue and you have some way to assess margins. I would also argue for HPV typing as part of the protocol or any protocol like it, all the reasons that I had have already been mentioned, so I won't go over that. The length of course of the treatment is not specified. The length of the follow-up, 1 year, would seem to be far too short in my estimation, given what we understand of the natural history in at least in immunocompetent individuals. The frequency of the follow-up or the type of follow-up needs also to be specified, and I think that there needs to be stratification according to immune parameters, CD4 counts. My primary reservations about this concept sheet have to do with the relative lack of pilot data. And I would be happy to be corrected on this. I could find, first of all, for isotretinoin, I could find no evidence of pilot data in which isotretinoin or a drug of its type had been used in the lower genital tract. The few literature citations I found had to do with use in head and neck tumors. And I think that there's some important issues about that. There's also a relative lack of pilot data on the use of systemic interferon with cervical dysplasia. Most of the literature on interferon, most of the gynecologic literature, has to do with the treatment of condylomata or genital warts, and is either in which the interferon is either given systemically or by intralesional injection, and with response rates in the 40% to 70% range. I found one study which involved perilesional injection of interferon in 14 patients who were HIV positive. Most of these were men, and seven were given interferon, seven placebo, and six of the seven, these again had to do just with warts. There was improvement in six of the seven given interferon and three of the seven who had placebo. There were two studies that I found that addressed or attempted to address the issue of interferon and cervical dysplasia. Both of those had to do with intralesional injection. It didn't specify exactly how they were done. And one of those found some benefit, and one of those found no benefit. So I think that there's still a relative, there's inadequate, I would postulate inadequate pilot data concerning the use of at least systemic interferon in the treatment of intraepithelial neoplasia. Some very practical concerns is obviously a study, not this can be overcome, but it's certainly something to consider. This involves an injection and a daily injection, which would either require, obviously, the woman to come back to her provider for her to do it herself or for someone to do it for her. And again, that's not certainly something that can't be overcome, but it's a little more complicated than a topical or oral treatment. The side effects of interferon are not an insignificant consideration. Most of the side effects are sort of flu-like illnesses, which of course could be confused with certain HIV-related side effects. Fever, malaise, fatigue, also neutropenia, and some other biochemical effects which can be seen in higher doses. And I wonder what
this has to do with some of the preclinical and clinical data about the interactions between interferons and retinoids that were not dealt with in Don Northfeld's proposal, which, at least from a theoretical standpoint, makes it I think a more interesting combination, although it certainly doesn't deal with the toxicity issues. And among these are the fact that there are a number of studies now in vitro showing strong synergy or super additivity with combinations of interferon with various kinds of retinoids. And this has been shown for interferon alpha as well as interferon gamma, and is true both for anti-proliferative effects as well as effects on transformed phenotype of certain cells in culture. I think that, you know, in itself is quite interesting and is a relatively recent observation. The other thing is that there have been some early studies, some of which have not been published yet, and some published only in abstract form, looking at the combination of systemically administered interferon alpha with systemically administered Accutane, both in squamous cell carcinoma of the skin, and also some data that I've recently become aware of in